The first part of this tape, made with John Latham, comprises a scripted series of questions and responses. They were produced by Latham following two previous recording sessions, which Latham subsequently felt did not clearly or fully articulate his often misunderstood and complex ideas. The latter part of the tape is, however, unscripted. Following the section with Latham, which lasts for 30 minutes, Andy Warhol is heard fielding questions at the press preview of his exhibition of camouflage self-portraits at the Anthony Doffey Gallery. John, you've gone on record as saying that if the idea of artist in artist placement is taken as an extension of art and not as a means of employment for artists, many anomalies in the present state of affairs will fall into place. I'd like to discuss what you mean by this. You begin from a, and I quote, point of intersection between, and I quote again, form as art and formulation as science. I don't believe any of this is on record in the art world. How did such an intersection occur?
We're talking about the point in minimalism reached in 1954 when I had a spray gun in my studio which I'd bought on a hunch. There happened to be two far-out scientists in the locality who I knew about as a team interested in finding common ground between physics and biology. It seemed an exciting project, and it was an extraordinary one when they invited me to make a mural at their place. It was when I remembered the spray gun in my drawer that all the connections began to come together.
What happened then?
Well, I went along, knowing instinctively that the constellations, the simplest application of this spray machine, would do a lot of work both for the astronomer and for the psychological biologist there. It would do it for myself as well. It turned out just like that. Within the following week, they, on their part, had set up an institute for studying mental images, in which I was invited as an honorary founder member, and I too had found a new approach to painting, which was sculpture as well, in fact. In the event, it spelt form. It was a new approach to form, which I later called formation. Now, that was a very exhilarating time.
You say there that you extended that word form to formation.
Yes.
And I know that subsequently you have used as a label to a lot of your works the term noit, N-O-I-T, which is in fact a reversal of that suffix ition. Could you explain why it was that you used that?
I was hunting around for what I could say to define what I was doing as against art, as it was then thought of. And the idea of getting the suffix T-I-O-N as a reification of some verbal activity and switching it back to front was to state the strategy of art as I was seeing it and to get some of the dynamics into it as well.
You have a long record of exhibited work. Earlier this year, I saw some in the Listen Gallery that were dating from 1954, and there were some relatively new things there. It was mainly a show of sculptures made from books. None of it seems to have been seen around the gallery circuits, however. Would you like to say how they came about and what the Institute had to do with it?
Yes, after the start of the ISMAI, I made a very large number of works, and they went into exhibitions and had, well, a tremendous initial success. The bookworks had a kind of scandalous success, particularly in Oxford. But what is here to the point, I thought the Gregorys, the scientists were Professor Gregory and Anita Cosen, by the way, Anita being his wife and colleague, I thought they would sort out how to say what had happened. And I would never have to utter about it ever again. Now, the process developed like a ready-made. Their work, their explanation, while very useful to me, seemed to falter when it came to public circuitry. I had to do something then to point out that the vocabulary of art criticism was hopelessly lost too in relation to this work.
I pick up some of the salient points that appear in various publications with your name on them. You say at one point that art history has been misconstruing what has happened over the last 30 years. You've advocated the artist as incidental person, relative to government in government departments. You've said that event structure will provide the overarching structure that is missing from affairs, and how it crosses purposes with language. You make out that this intersection warrants a lot of attention. Let's start with this contention that, and I quote, "The mark is an index of the art trajectory through stages in the inquiry in art," unquote. Can you say what you have in mind?
Very much. I started when there was Tachism in all the galleries. Tachism was aiming at taking the literary references out of a painting and at truth to the medium. I recognized that there was a relation between the touch of Tachists and the now available atomized touch mark. If I call this a quantized mark, it can be thought of as an interpretation of that, and of not only that, but the Jackson Pollock's vertical action marks, which dated from about 1948 to 1952. Then, though I hadn't heard about it, there'd been a blank canvas, a virgin canvas, exhibited in 1951 by Rauschenberg. This piece, more surely than any that you can see in the record, starts off or triggers that loss of direction that I've gone on about. Rauschenberg clearly meant to be putting up a sign for a dead end on the minimal art trajectory. But on another and wider view, this blank canvas was in parallel with a point made by Einstein, reached in 1915, in general relativity, which seemed to say that the universe would collapse not to something very small, but to nothing whatsoever, i.e. a dimensionless point. So, a no-mark painting, and I suppose that monochrome canvases such as Eve Klein were doing, were saying it more intentionally, was a very real statement about something to do with our relation to the universe in its nothing aspect.
Has there been any progress at all from such a dead-end position? We have no sign in art, do we, that one can go anywhere from there?
Well, that's been the conventional wisdom. And I think the point is simply missed. Let's consider it. Nothing is zero extendedness. And if we think of the idea of extension and non-extension as the basis of objects, the idea of timeless and timelessness becomes quite easy to visualize. What we have to do is to consider it in terms of event. It's only when you insist on the world in terms of objects, particles, masses, etc., that the idea is in trouble. But that's what's built into ordinary linguistic logic, that's to say positivistic logic. Now, a musical work extends during its performance, but then it arrives at non-extension when it's finished, and it has quite a different status in time at the end of that, because the score of the musical piece is all there all the time and is simply non-extended. Now, do you see the difference there? You don't think of an object as in any sense non-extended, or even possibly so.
But we're not talking about music. We're talking about sculpture and paintings that are objects and that do stay the same.
No, that's a case that's been blown. Once time has been recognised as part of sculptural dimensionality, and I think that this needs to have been brought into art critique, art criticism, in a much more methodical way. The event-structured dimensionality introduces as a visual the same set of dimensions that do apply precisely in music, and it must also apply to the world of objects.
Do you mean like in your roller paintings?
Yes, I do that. It was the way that, quote, time, unquote, came to be in direct association with an atemporal condition, that's to say, the painted surface, the plain surface of the canvas, that is still, quote, all there all the time, unquote, on the roller. That's to say, it's wrapped up in the roller. And you're seeing time as it unrolls. And then, with the spectrum of time-based bands, it's like seeing the spectroscopic analysis spectra from stars, giving the light of the elements as they appear, as they show up on the bands. This brought together the whole idea, and the inclusivity of event structure really stems from that.
Well, moving on now, John, in the 60s there were happenings, we know, which incorporated time, but we don't see very much evidence or interest in works that incorporate time right now.
There's still a big movement to lose temporality, but I think that we've all been taken in. I think the art world's been taken in by the razzmatazz and by the money that goes for artworks that don't move. Look at the real big time history for a start, and go back over literature and to Plato and the very early records. Now, Chomsky pointed out not so very long ago in an interview on The Box that in regard to certain very important questions like the sources of human action, there has been no progress. Even today, it's still the same questions we're asking, he said. Well, we can write novels about it, he said, but we can't construct even false scientific theories about it. The historical trajectory of art led down through this very fundamental inquiry to the question, which is one of the dimensionality, not of things, but of person, art, mental action, organisms, and so on. And I have to persuade people to look carefully and tell me, if this dimensional frame doesn't resolve the dimensional problem, then I want them to say, how not? The impression I have is that the terms of a spatial reality that we use now, with its incompatible mind language, the language of mental activity, this dualism is so ingrained a habit that no one is able to spare the time and attention to look where event structure will bring them together. There's even a covert embargo in force in official circuits to try to cook this record, to eliminate any such development from the history.
In one of your publications, the Surveyor Report, published in 1984, you have an appendix about that and about money and the incidental person idea. This report starts with a series of propositions suggesting that the condition you're talking about is a disease. Divided state disease, you call it. It's difficult to follow the arguments unless you're a multi-specialist. How do you propose to get such an idea into circulation?
I'd say you look, wherever you look, you can see the effect in operation. We look at the international situation, for instance. There is incoherence at United Nations level, and there's incoherence at personal levels, and it's getting worse. My impression is that we're getting more frustrated and less able to handle relations of this kind. Wouldn't it be worth looking now to see if they don't all stem from this one failure to get the dimensional frameworks into a common frame? Look at the extravagance involved, for instance, in ignoring the possibility. There's an annual spending bill on arms budgets of £1,000 billion. Let's say £1 trillion a year is going on means of obliteration. That's part of the bill. Nothing yet is being said about the pain budget, the risk budget, the cost of the planet, perhaps. So let's not get ourselves drowned in this very small pool set aside for, quote, art, unquote. We need an entrepreneur or something on a very large scale to fund something which is tackling this mega problem.
As once involved in a government department placement with the DHSS, I know the difference between this approach and the subsidised official kind of placement. But with the political situation as it is, it's hard to see any impact being made on the major issues and problems.
Well, that's because I suggest you haven't studied the blueprint or the possibilities of persuasion that have been developing. These money scales, as I'm pointing out, are as astronomical as you can get. We were hardly allowed in 1975, 1976, for instance, to get started at all, even after the full approval of the Civil Service Department in Whitehall. And even though the success of the pilot projects was phenomenal, in my view, and unchallenged, all the artists took off. Records have been made within these departments, and the examples have been followed. However, they've been followed with a studied incomprehension by our own funding bodies, who seem to aim to seize the whole idea and pass it off as theirs. A vigilante group either in Piccadilly or in Westminster, perhaps, where the traps were set, would be the only people to tell you how and why. But now that such covert criminal behaviour on the part of governments is so general and so approved, I rather understand your scepticism.
You mention Eve Clyde and his monochromatic canvases, and I know that certain critics, such as Rosetta Brooks and John Stesica, have written of your work and its relation to Eve Klein's, particularly the work in the mid-50s, the figure paintings. Were you aware of what Klein was doing at that time? And how do you see the relationship between what you were doing and what he was doing, which is certainly visually quite similar now?
It's an interesting idea. I think I had the idea of the vertical mark as a very important facet, a very important element to maintain, so that the apparent contact of the body with the surface of the painting is similar. But I didn't have anything to do with Eve Klein, personally. I saw his monochrome paintings about the same time as my first spray gun paintings, and I thought they were very powerful and very interesting, but I couldn't compete or do anything like in response to it. I knew they were different, and when I met him and he met me, it was over an exhibition of mine in Dusseldorf. We had nothing to say to one another.
Have there been any artists over that period between the early 50s and now that you have actually found you have something in common with and you've had a dialogue with?
There has been something of a difficulty here. In St. Martin's, for instance, there was a big flourishing sculpture school that I could recognise as tentatively introducing a temporal, classical temporal element, like Tony Caro in his early new sculpture had got a wonderful device for showing the same kind of form in a different configuration down a railway line. Now that, I thought, was going to be quite startlingly original and new. Then there was Barry Flanagan, who used process, and Barry and I got along extremely well and exchanged a lot of ideas, and I think we interacted quite spontaneously at the time when he was a student. I was supposed to be on the staff at St. Martin's. We weren't supposed to cross over because painting and sculpture didn't talk to each other in that way, so we used to meet in the pub in Soho. And as you probably know, Barry and I organised that Still and True party at which the book was the Greenberg book was chewed up, mainly from Barry's department, I may say. It was mainly from the sculpture department that these people came and somewhat hesitantly chewed away at this text.
Could I ask a question about that? Because if people who are not familiar with your work know anything of it at all, then it's that event which, as you say, involved you organising a party at which a copy of Greenberg's Art and Culture was chewed up by the people who came, and then the resultant pulp distilled. Do you feel now that that is somehow a kind of notorious event which is almost an albatross around your neck and is often misinterpreted? Or does it still seem really quite an important gesture for you?
I think I interpret it personally, and I'm just about to restate. Art and Culture 1987 is a title I have proposed for a New York show next month. Now, that's interesting also because Rosetta Brooks is associated with the gallery where it is. I'm proposing that the Art and Culture 87 tells the real story rather than the rather fortuitous kind of romantic story of the happenings going on in St. Martin, simply because my proposal to the authorities in St. Martin's that a study of time group should be brought together, and consciously that we should look at what time had to do with making art and presenting it and so on. And that had been turned down with such finality that I said, well, something else has to be done. And the Art and Culture episode was the something else that was done. But the time and event system was common to all each one of us. And I think that is what's going to come out as the Art and Culture of 1987, I'd hope.
You've said recently that even now, within the scientific community, there is still a lack of awareness of the kinds of issues around the notion of time that you have been talking about. Could you say something about that?
It's not usually recognised that in theory of physics, they've got two theories and they can't get them together. There's a quantum mechanical theory and there's an Einsteinian relativity theory, and they both seem to be right. And at the moment, it's being suggested that in order to account for all the said forces in relativity theory, it's necessary to invent or to postulate totally conceptual dimensionality with 10 coordinates of space. Now, this is called super, whatever it is, super gravity, supersymmetry, etc. And it's being worked on frenetically all around the world. My position is simply that if we could persuade them to see the dimensional framework of event, it would be entirely unnecessary to postulate 10 dimensions of space. One would see that the ordering, as opposed to the energy, if we can see the universe as ordered according to a range of time-based sources, we would see that those forces were invented at different stages, very early stages, certainly, right at the very, very beginning. Forces known in physics turn up one after the other if the postulate of an insistently recurrent event universe is granted. I think that you would then find that the infinitely small concept in 10-dimensional parlance that is being pushed around, like in Scientific American, for instance, I feel that would translate very well into the interpretation in terms of longer or shorter time-based orderings of events.
When we spoke before, you talked about, in relation to your bookworks, about there being political issues stashed away in them. the phrase stuck in my mind, and I was wondering if you could be more specific.
Fundamentally, our political situation in the world today is predicated, let's say it's based, and it derives from a conclusion which was reached in, what, the 17th century, when one of the philosophers, and it happened to be a French, Descartes, who said, the fact that I think makes me exist in a way that material reality doesn't exist. Let's say one is inert and the other is active. And the dualistic framework which has he perpetuated and reinforced, having come through from the very beginning of the academic origins of the academe, means that we have no idea, or we have a very privatized idea as to where authority exists, where authority comes from, where the sources of authority come from. Now, if we have got a subjective idea of where such authority comes from, it shows up in multiform political stratagems, ways of organizing order or of insisting on order or of arriving at order from a supposedly democratic and broad-based system. Every time that you talk, you use the word democracy, it's different. Each person has a different idea. The point about the book reliefs is that it starts at a point anterior to where politics started to be defined, and what it also offers is taken in conjunction with the approach to painting, which comes from an atomized mark. The atomized mark came before the book reliefs, and it was in this exhibition represented in one painting, which you saw as a figure. Well, that atomized mark crystallizes and focuses art as a tradition onto a point where it switches from the idea of a world of objects and a world of mind into a world of events which subsumes objects and minds. Very important, because if we can sort that out, we can then start to approach the idea of how politically we organize ourselves.
For some time now, you've propounded an event-based theory as an explanation as to how experience and, let's say, the creative impulse asserts and reasserts itself, this being opposite to the linguistically based sequential modernist argument. You've applied this theory not only to art but also to science.
It has in fact been corroborated by an observation which was reported only, what, 6 months ago. And that, taken in conjunction with Steve Hawking, means that, very interesting thing, the universe is, according to Hawking, an oscillation. In my terms, invented before I read that, an insistently recurrent event. The critical confirmation that we have had 6 months ago was a reading of the density of dust and matter in outer space as being precisely enough to show that the momentum of expansion there is in the expanding universe is balanced by what we would call gravitational force, or what the physicists call gravitational force, which would reduce it, pull it back, stop it expanding, bring it back to nothing. Now, the reversion, that the return to zero, has been an awful problem for everybody to understand, because they can't think of all matter going into no matter at all. But if you think of it in terms of event, an event is either being enacted or it's not being enacted. And when it's not being enacted, you can say it's not extending. Non-extendedness is a key concept in event structure which doesn't fit physics.
Thank you.
Can we ask you, were these paintings made specifically for this exhibition at Antony Dobby Gallery?
Yeah, they were.
Yeah. And, I mean, would you be making portraits otherwise, or was this a specific invitation?
Yeah, it was done that way. I'm just doing camouflage, so, and then I put my portrait on top of the camouflage.
Right, but they're actual screen-printed pieces of work, aren't they?
And hand-touched.
How do you feel about your original remark about everybody being famous 15 minutes?
We have a TV show called that.
Called?
With 15 minutes.
Right. And do you find it more prophetic as time goes by? The telecommunications, the increase and all this kind of thing.
I think it's been reduced, don't you? Yes, at least five.
Right. At least five.
Five.
When you made that remark, was it with reference to the star syndrome and Hollywood creating?
No. Just
what made
everybody
it, what
on,
made you say
well
it?
Because television's around. Everybody's on television all the time.
Yeah. Sorry,
everybody's on television all the time. And then whenever I'm on television, they know me for the day, and then they forget about you unless you're on television all the time.
Why do you think they do forget so quickly?
Well, because there's so many other people on that they have to forget about too.
Is that a good thing ultimately? That everybody has their shot.
Yeah.
And the strong survive.
Yeah. Well, no, usually everybody does. Sooner or later.
Would you let's go out room?
Oh, there's more room.
To the front.
Oh, okay.
Oh, you mean just by the desk?
Yeah.
You must be familiar with the characters like Boy George.
Oh, no, I didn't know. That man just told me over there. I saw him in New York. He was terrific.
Really? Just walk over to
the
window.
I didn't mean his current situation, but I meant the fact that he was like a shooting star.
Nick Rhodes, your best friend. Nick Rhodes is his best friend.
Yeah. Nick Rhodes, yes, he's quite friendly with all you guys.
His wife is so pretty.
She's expecting a baby any minute.
Andrew Richards got a great looking girlfriend, too.
Oh, really?
Andrew, have you got any plans at the moment to make a film?
Oh, well,
go ahead, Billy, keep going. Up by the window.
Andrew
with
the
New York. It's a new film. See you tomorrow.
Are you going?
He has, you know what he has? He has 16,000 Barbie dolls. That's what he's famous for. What is he that famous for?
Well, I don't really know if I'm famous for it. Andy also. Probably much likes it. Something, I think it's a big amount.
When is Barbie coming here?
David, you're welcome. Do they feature an interview with Barbie dolls?
No, but I did Barbie's portrait, and that was my
great painting of Barbie.
Big this year.
People have often accused you of laughing at all the people who spend large sums of money on your paintings. Is there an element of irony, do you think, as you produce works that sell for $65,000, like the one behind you?
Oh, I don't think they sell.
Some of them have sold, and the exhibition hasn't started.
Oh.
You're at least 70,000 or 80,000 richer this morning.
But they're very well worth it because of the moment, and anything that's of the moment has interest for the moment, and for whatever effect it has, people appreciate it. So whatever the value is, it's just worth it.
Yeah.
You're answering to the sense of irony.
No, I don't.
Is there then a social comment in any of your work?
No, I just do whatever I do, just to get by.
You're getting by quite comfortably.
I know, with these two people next to me, I guess so.
He's pretty comfortable. Seems to have a lot of fun all the time.
How much do you think of your success as an artist, probably the best known in the world at the moment, is as a result of your own personal image, yourself as a work of art?
That's what everybody says. I don't know. I work all the time.
And what about film and video? You don't seem to have done so much in that
area.
We're
working on a TV show called Any World's 15 Minutes, which is 30 minutes long. So we actually do a lot of film, like cable stuff, and then we do. We bought a new script called Slaves of New York by Tamma Janowitz. So we do a little bit of everything.
You're still a very busy man, then.
Yeah, we're just a little bit.
Thank you very much.
Oh, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Is this series of paintings now complete? The ones that you see in the gallery?
Yeah, I think I have to do some over.
I played Mrs. Pig in the Roundhouse in your play.
You did? How great.
I did. And you came over, and the producer said I didn't have an authentic American accent, and you said I did, so great, thank you.
Was that your 15 minutes of fame?
No, she's probably working a lot.
How do you feel about making paintings at this moment in time? Because you work in all sorts of media. I mean, what function do you think the painting?
No, actually, I do that every day.
Paint?
Yeah.
Yeah. What, using mechanical imagery? Or do you make any drawings?
No, sometimes I paint a lot of hand painting. I paint the background.
Right.
And then do you change the paintings afterwards?
Paint over them.
Yeah. Completely.
Sometimes.
What major projects do you have planned for the future?
Well, I'm trying to get up in the morning. Actually, the best club that's going to open is by Lil Nell. She's opening a newest club in New York.
Who?
Lil Nell.
The singer?
Yeah, she's opening one in 2 weeks or something.
Really?
Yeah, it's supposed to be the whole new idea and stuff in clubs.
And where have you moved out to?
We just moved more in the center of town.
Is that the factory? The whole thing's moved?
Our office, yeah.
So where are you now? So the 50-something street?
No, 34th Street.
And
Madison.
Do you still like Nick Rose?
Oh, yeah, we just saw him. You just saw him the other day.
His wife's opening a shop, I think, now. She's gone into the fashion business.
Oh, she did? Oh, I didn't know that. I thought she was having a baby.
Well, you can do better, I guess.
Oh, she can do well.
Are there any artists in Britain that you particularly admire or that interest you? Any work coming from here?
I David Hockney is the one that I like the most, but everybody's Henry Morris are great.
What's your view of recent American painters, such as Schnabel and so on? Do you find their work interesting?
Oh, yeah, they're all friends of mine. I really like them a lot. Kenny Jarre painted my camera, but it got stuck. Keith Haring is terrific. And Jean-Michel Basquiat. Oh, there's so many. I don't know.
Are you working in a movie right now?
Oh, we're trying.
Which one is it?
It's called Slaves of New York by Tammy Janowitz.
Is he's a director?
It's a girl. No, it's a girl. She writes for the New Yorker.
And she's done the screenplay?
Yeah.
Would you direct it yourself?
Maybe.
What's it about?
Oh, just people living with other people.
How long are you going to stay over here in London?
Just a couple of days.
Are you still interested in writing books? Are you still interested in the idea of a novel? Experimentation.
A little bit.
I'm
writing a book on how to go to a party.
On how to give a party?
How to give a party.
You're still really interested in parties?
No.
You're not?
What's your impression of London so far?
It's actually, it's so exciting. It's just incredible.
When was the last time you were here?
I don't know, for one of the Wimbledon games. I can't remember.
Have you been in 20 clubs in London?
Not yet, no.
Where would you like to go?
We're going to go to the Jungle Club and the Wag Club and the Café de Paris and every single one every night.
Did you hear about a club from Taboo?
Yeah.
It's a pity that's closed. It'd have been a good club for you to go to.
What's the other clubs? Heaven, Taboo, Café de Paris.
Yeah,
they have it all lined up for us every night.
All right.
You're going to be here for the opening of the Limelight?
I don't think so, because they're opening the 15th, I think, aren't they?
They're going to be one of the best clubs here.
Isn't it?
I think so, yeah. Have you seen the interior? It's really great. It's going to be a good club.
Andy's my friend, and I collect Barbie dolls, and that's what he just tried to say. Andy just did a great painting of Barbie doll, and it's kind of
That's how we met.
Have you seen any TV commercials since you've been here?
Oh, they're really good, yeah.
They've become really the state of the art now.
I know.
A lot of the advertising, a lot of the video directors came from advertising.
The new poodle.
And that's kind of increased their own confidence.
They're really good. Well, you know, the English movies are getting so good. I mean, I just saw Mona Lisa, and I thought it was terrific.
That's right. Which one?
Mona Lisa. They're all big hits in New York now. I think English movies are going to be the best ever. Room and a View and everything. They're just great.
Any particular directors or producers you sort of
well,
rate? Or actors,
you know? Well, my favorite actress was the Tyson girl. She's so great.
Which girl?
Tyson. Is it?
Tyson.
The last name. No. Tyson. She's in Mona Lisa. Is that her name, Tyson?
I'll check it out.
Yeah.
How do you think this show looks in the gallery?
Oh, it looks beautiful. Yeah.
You're pleased with it, aren't you?
Yeah, they really made it look nice. Yeah.
Had you made more works, and have you left any out, or is this exactly the number you made? What interested you in this project of making new portraits for this gallery in London? Because presumably you could, you know, what's the incentive for doing it, you think?
I don't know.
Why do you do self-portraits?
Well, Anthony Dolphy asked me.
Do you like doing self-portraits better?
No, I like people. No, I like other people to do it. Yeah. People.
Painting still stand up as a fact. That's what you said once about the painting, that all it is a fact.
Yeah.
That's the idea of you, and that's it.
Yeah.
That's still really interesting.
Yeah.
One person's interpretation or vision, if one must take it quite far.
Have you been sort of pleased or surprised about the response to you in London this time?
Oh, surprised.
Yeah. Why is that?
Pleased.
Just do George. George. When you go back to New York, what projects will you be working on?
Working on Sister.
What am I working on? He's working on a movie, Tamar Janowitz's Slaves of New York, and I think he's doing a new series of paintings right now, and he's doing a lot of things, actually, shopping a lot.
Right.
You're shopping a lot. So you went shopping this afternoon. Where did you go to, and what did you buy?
He went shopping in the clothing stores, and he was looking in Krola. And a number of the other fashion shops, Kenzo, Gucci.
I'm going to ask you a question. I don't know if you can answer me or not, but what is your definition of being famous? Is it being the centre of attention, or is it being recognised by everyone?
You don't think about it?
No. Do you want your name in it? Or,
pardon?
Do you want your name in it?
Yes, please. Eleanor. E-L-E-N-A. E-N-A. That's it.
Is that right?
And, oh, you signed it. Thanks.
Good for
you. What's that one?
Oh, it looks great, yeah.
Barry Artist. This gentleman right here, Barry Artist.
Welcome to